Śrīmad-gyāna-timidandasya gyānañjana-śalākāya chakṣurunmilitam nena tasmai śrī-guruve namaha śrī-caitanya-manopiṣṭam stāpitam yena bhūtale svayam rūpa katāmayam tatāti svāpatantikam vandeham śrī-guru śrī-yuta padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sarvatutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindo Dina Bando Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Rishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kulpatrubhascha Kripa Sindubhye Vacha Patitanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasari Gaura Bhaktivinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Gaur Premanande Hare Bo. So tonight we begin the reading of the Ramayana leading up to the divine appearance day of Sri Ramachandra on the 19th of April. This is the Ramayana, India's immortal tale of adventure, love and wisdom retold by Krishna Dharma. Introduction. Ramayana is the first of the great epics of ancient India. It is written in the tradition of the Vedas, following the wisdom of those timeless Sanskrit scriptures. Originally compiled by the sage Valmiki, it is famous as the Adikavya, or the original poem. Its origins are lost in distant antiquity, although followers of the Vedic tradition say it was first composed around 880,000 BC. Of course, many modern scholars and scientists will undoubtedly take issue with that claim. It matters little, though. When it was written, Ramayana remains one of the most moving and beautiful stories of all time. It tells the history of Ram, a king who appeared in the solar dynasty, the king descending from the sun god Surya. Ram and his wife Sita are said by the Vedas to be manifestations of Vishnu and Lakshmi, who are accepted as the supreme person and his eternal consort. Ram is described as the seventh of the ten avatars or incarnations of Vishnu who appear in the current cycle of ages. The book can thus be read on different levels. On one level, it is simply a wonderful story. For lovers of tales like The Lord of the Rings, it is an account of fantastic happenings in a world of magic and mysticism, a world where humans lived alongside other more powerful beings and where human society itself possessed knowledge of divine forces now unknown. For those fascinated by different cultures, Ramayana graphically depicts the so-called Vedic Age, a time when great warrior kings ruled the world, guided by spiritually aware mystics and saints. It was an age when men lived in the understanding that they were eternal souls passing from life to life towards a state of final emancipation. Thus, the pursuit of virtue and truth was considered paramount, and human life was seen as an opportunity to attain spiritual liberation, freedom from the cycle of birth and death. But for those who accept the divinity of Ram, Ramayana becomes a different affair. If Ram is accepted as God, then it may be questioned, why does he appear? What is he doing as he moves about the earth, seeming to act exactly like an ordinary man? Such questions are answered in the renowned spiritual treatise, Bhagavad Gita, the Song of God. Therein it is stated that God appears in this world for different reasons. He comes to establish religion and to destroy demonic elements in society when they become too powerful. but he also appears in order to reciprocate the love of his devotees. In this last fact, it is this last fact which is most significant and which is said to be the primary reason for the Lord's appearance. The Bhagavad Gita explains that the Lord has no material purpose to fulfill when he appears. He is not acting in the same way as ordinary men who are interested in material gains such as profit, fame, and adoration. Nor does the Lord have any political purpose. He is simply acting out of love. If Ramayana is studied with this in mind, it becomes an immensely profound and deeply moving literature. The various interactions between Ram and the other characters are seen in a different light, a light of divine loving sentiments that can touch the very soul of the reader. I shall leave you to judge for yourself. However you view the Ramayana, I am confident you will find it enjoyable and uplifting. I have read it at least a dozen times and am still finding great pleasure in reading it again and again. I hope you will also experience the same joy from this book. Krishna Dharma Das, September 1999. Shraddha, I don't know what happened, but about 4 or 5 minutes ago, some switch was moved, and I'm getting some noise, some like kind of feedback or something.
In any case, but Maharaj, we are able to hear you perfectly clearly.
Okay.
Yeah.
I heard a click, and then all of a sudden, every time I talk, there's just the slightest little feedback. But maybe impossible to figure out. We'll just chalk it up to the most annoying thing on earth, which is the advance of technology. Okay, prologue. Coursing through the sky in his celestial chariot, Ravan appeared like a blazing comet. His dark body shone with a brilliant aura. From his 10 heads, his reddish eyes darted about, scouring the mountains below. His 20 powerful arms hanging from his huge frame looked like 5-hooded serpents. Seated on a throne of gems, he directed his golden chariot by thought alone, and it moved swiftly over the Himalayan range. The demon was out on his conquests. All around him flew thousands of rakshasas, clutching swords, barbed spears, spiked maces, and iron bludgeons, all of these weapons smeared with blood. Some rakshasas had the heads of tigers, some of donkeys, and some of fierce fiends. Others appeared in their natural forms, large blackish bodies, fearful faces, with tall pointed ears and rows of sharp fangs, with a mass of red hair on their heads. They wore iron breastplates studded with gems and were adorned with bright gold earrings and other shining ornaments. Surrounding Ravan, they looked like dark clouds and lightning covering the sky. Ravan wished to defeat in battle even the gods themselves. Wanting to establish his supreme power in the universe, he had gone to the higher planets and conquered hosts of Gandharvas and Yakshas, powerful celestial fighters. Now he was returning from his victorious fight with Kuvera, his own brother and the treasure of the gods. That lordly deity had been made to retreat by Ravan, losing to the demon his wonderful chariot known in all the worlds as Pushpaka. The fearless Ravan, overlord of all the demons, looked down from the Pushpaka at the forest below. It was a picture of tranquility. Amongst the trees were many verdant clearings covered with varieties of wild shrubs and forest flowers. Crystal waterfalls cascaded onto many colored rocks. Lakes filled with lotuses and swans shone from the mountain plateaus as the hordes of rakshasas soared overhead. Sometimes the demons would see groups of rishis, ascetic Brahmins who dwelt in those high mountain ranges, practicing austerities and worshiping the gods. They would see the columns of smoke rising up amongst the trees from the sacrificial fires tended by the sages. Using their powers of sorcery, the rakshasas dropped down volumes of blood, feces, and urine, defiling the sacrifices. They would then hurl huge boulders and blazing coals, crushing and burning the sages where they sat in meditation. Finally, the demons would themselves descend, howling and roaring. They tore apart the bodies of the rishis, drinking their blood and devouring their flesh. Ravan admired the Pushpaka as it proceeded according to his will. His brother Kuvera would be sorry to lose such a splendid vehicle. It looked more like a city of gods floating in the air than a chariot. Numerous cat's eyes and crystal pillars ran along its sides, supporting golden mansions inlaid with coral. Large floors made entirely of gems stood upon gold statues of lions and tigers. Groves of artificial trees, shining with golden leaves and fruits, surrounded large ponds crowded with white lotuses. In those clear ponds stood ivory elephants and silver goddesses. Networks of pearls and wreaths of celestial flowers hung all over that car. It was encrusted with countless precious stones and emblazoned with gold carvings of wolves, sharks, and fierce bears. Sweeping through the skies, it emitted the sounds of celestial music and the fragrance of the Parijat flower, known only to the gods. As Ravan sat idly aboard the chariot, gazing around at the magnificent scenery below, he suddenly noticed a lady sitting in meditation. This was most unusual. Women were rarely seen in those mountains. Sometimes the rishis would have their wives with them, but this woman seemed to be entirely alone. Ravan slowed the chariot, and moved down to look more closely. Perhaps there were more ascetics nearby. The Rakshasas could use a little entertainment. And if this woman was as beautiful as she seemed at the first glance, so could he. Ordering the Rakshasas to wait in the sky, Ravan himself rose up from the chariot and descended to the ground. He saw the young ascetic girl sitting on a flat piece of soft grassland surrounded by wild flowers. She glowed with a golden beauty. Her limbs were exquisitely formed, and her full breasts were covered by a black deerskin. Ravan could see the contours of her tapering thighs through the thin cloth covering her crossed legs. Dark locks of thickly matted hair hung down to her waist, framing her white-complexioned face. Her red lips moved slightly as she intoned the sacred syllable Om. Her smooth golden arms were bared in front of her as she sat with folded palms, her long curling lashes covering half-closed eyes. Ravan's mind was overpowered by lust. Who was this youthful lady? What was she doing here in this solitary, lonely place? Did she have a protector? Never mind. He would soon deal with that. The forest was no place for such a maiden. She would make an excellent addition to his other consorts. By his mystic power, Ravan assumed a human form and approached the girl. He spoke loudly, disturbing her reverie. Oh, most beautiful maiden. Oh, most beautiful maiden, who are you? Why are you practicing asceticism in this lonely region? To whom do you belong? What fortunate man has you for his wife? The demon was unable to resist the charms of women. As he gazed upon the alluring form of the girl, he was possessed by increasing desire. He laughed and waited for her to reply. The girl fully opened her black eyes and looked at Ravan. Seeing him as a guest in her hermitage, she spoke respectfully, telling him her name. She was Vedavati, the daughter of a powerful sage, who was himself a son of the god's preceptor, Brihaspati. Looking down in shyness, she said, I was born as an incarnation of the holy Vedas. My father was sought by numerous gods and other celestial beings who wished to have my hand in marriage. However, none but Vishnu, the Lord of all the worlds, can be my spouse. Thus I am seated here, absorbed in thought of the Lord and waiting his favor. Vedavati had meditated for thousands of years. Her body, like that of the gods, neither aged nor required any sustenance. She could understand by her own inner vision who Ravana was and what was his intention. In gentle tones, she said that only Vishnu could be her husband. That inconceivable Lord was all-powerful and all-seeing, and she had chosen him alone. She could not belong to anyone else. Ravan could continue on his way as before. Ravan laughed again. He was not going to leave behind this jewel of a woman. Hearing the name of Vishnu, his sworn enemy, only made him all the more determined. The demon's voice boomed like thunder. Your resolution to practice austerity befits only old women, O lady of shapely limbs. Why do you waste your fleeting youth in this way? I am Ravan, lord of the Rakshasas, the very mighty race of demons. Become my wife and live with me in my capital, Lanka, the golden city I forcibly seize from the gods. Who is this Vishnu anyway? Ravan spoke derisively of Vishnu, whom he knew to be the lord of all the gods. The arrogant demon cared nothing for any universal authority. He had been granted boons by Brahma, the creator of the universe, who had so blessed the Rakshasa that he could not be killed by practically any created being, neither god nor demon. Ravan could assume forms at will. Vedavati's mention of Vishnu did not bother him in the least. He stood smiling before the maiden, his eyes full of lust. Hearing Ravan deride Vishnu, Vedavati flared up with anger and rebuked the demon. She told him to leave immediately for his own good, lest he incite the powerful anger of that supreme deity. Ravan smiled. This high-spirited woman would make a perfect consort for him. He stepped forward and grabbed hold of her long locks. Vedavati at once uttered a powerful Sanskrit mantra, which momentarily checked the demon's advance. She lifted a hand and by her mystic power cut through her hair. The Rakshasa fell back in surprise as she spoke furiously, O evil one, I shall now quit this body defiled by your touch. As I have been insulted by you, I shall take birth again only for your destruction. Appearing from the earth, I shall become the pious daughter of a virtuous man. You and your entire race will be destroyed as a result of that birth. Vedavati closed her eyes and meditated on Vishnu, seeing him within her heart. Before Ravan's eyes, she invoked fire from within herself. Her body was immediately consumed by flames, and in a few moments, Ravan stood looking at her ashes. Baffled by her words, the disappointed demon rose again to his chariot and continued on his way. The demon and his Rakshasa followers spent some time in the Himalayan mountains, wreaking havoc among the many ascetics living there. Gradually they approached the far northern region, where there lay Mount Kailash, the abode of Shiva. As the Pushpaka began crossing that mountain, it was suddenly brought to a halt. Ravan was surprised, and he descended to the ground, surrounded by his ministers, who accompanied him on the chariot. As he gazed around at the brilliant scenery on the mountainside, he saw a strange being with a monkey's head. The creature appeared dreadful, with a dark yellowish complexion and misshapen features. Although his body was large, he had a dwarfish stature and was clean-shaven and muscular, and he stood holding a large glowing pike. As he gazed at Ravan, the demon called out to him, Who are you, and what is this region? Why have I been impeded? I am Nandi, the servant of Shiva, replied the unusual being. You have arrived at Shiva's abode, which is inaccessible to all created beings. You will not be able to pass this mountain. Therefore, turn back and go back the way you have come. Ravana looked at the strange body of Nandi and laughed out loud. He spoke in a derisory voice. Why should I heed you, O monkey-faced one? Who is this Shiva anyway? Hearing his master insulted, infuriated Nandi. Raising his pike, which shot forth tongues of fire, he exclaimed, O Rakshasa, I should kill you at once, but I will not do so, as you already stand killed by your own sins. But I say this, as you disregard me in my monkey form, there shall be born on earth many monkeys of terrible strength, who will annihilate your race. As Nandi spoke, the sound of heavenly drums reverberated in the sky, and a shower of flowers fell. Ravan's eyes flamed in anger. Disregarding the curse, he roared, I shall remove this hill from my path. What do I care for you and your master? The Rakshasa immediately plunged his 20 massive arms deep into the side of the hill. He began tearing it up, and it slowly rose above the earth, shaking violently. As the hill shook, Shiva's consort, Parvati, slipped from her position and clung to her husband. Shiva reassured her, "Do not be afraid. This is the action of the vain demon Ravan. I shall deal with him shortly. He cannot harm you." Parvati's eyes turned red as she replied to her powerful husband, "As this wretch has frightened a woman by his violence, his death shall be caused by a woman." Shiva stood up and pressed down upon the hill with his toe. Ravan at once felt an unbearable pressure. His arms, which resembled huge pillars holding the hill, were crushed. He let out a tremendous cry that resounded throughout the three worlds of heaven, earth, and hell, terrifying all beings. He was trapped by the weight of the mountain and he could not move. The Rakshasa's ministers at once surrounded him and advised him to appease Shiva. "We have heard how that all-powerful one is easily pleased. Offer him prayers and seek his compassion at once. Surely he will be gracious to you." Ravan, who had made a study of all the scriptures, began reciting hymns from the Samaveda in glorification of Shiva. But even after 100 years had passed, the Rakshasa still remained trapped. Although in great pain, he continued offering prayers to Shiva. Finally, Shiva relented and relieved Ravan of the pressure. He appeared before the demon and spoke kindly, "O ten-headed one, your prayers have pleased me. Do not be so rash again. Leave now and go wherever you like." Ravan bowed to the god who stood holding his famous trident. The crescent moon shone from his head, and a large serpent was coiled around his blue neck. He gazed at Ravan with his three eyes as the demon folded his palms to address him. "My lord, if you are actually pleased with me, then please give me your weapon." Shiva smiled. Ravan's lust for battle would prove to be his destruction before long. Saying, "So be it," Shiva raised his palm in benediction and immediately vanished from that spot. Ravan felt the mantras for invoking Shiva's powerful Pashupata weapon appear within his mind. He smiled. Who could resist such power? Even he had been unable to overcome Shiva. The great deity was surely worthy of his worship. Ravan mounted the Pushpaka, which had waited in the sky all the time he was trapped. Being unable to proceed further to the north, he turned back southward, still accompanied by his numerous Rakshasa forces. As he moved across the earth, seeking further martial engagements, he came upon the city of Ayodhya. This was the capital of the world of humans. The emperor of the earth dwelt there, and Ravan considered him as fit for a fight. If he conquered this king, then the whole earth would be subjugated. Ravan had little interest in human affairs. The Rakshasas were a superior race of beings, more on a level with the gods, but the demon wanted to establish his supremacy over all beings. His army of Rakshasas surrounded the city, challenging the emperor to battle. A fierce fight ensued between the two armies of Ravan and the Ayodhya king, Anaranya. Tens of thousands of chariots and elephants came onto the battlefield, along with hundreds of thousands of foot soldiers. Showers of arrows like swarms of black bees fell upon the demons. Anaranya's army threw lances, darts, steel bullets, and iron maces by the million. They swept toward the enemy, shouting courageously with their weapons raised. Ravan's forces used sorcery to appear and disappear at will, flying in the sky and hurling down rocks and sharp weapons. The king's army replied with showers of swift and deadly arrows. Using powerful catapults, the warriors threw at the Rakshasas large iron darts, which whistled through the air. But Anaranya's fighters could not easily engage with the elusive demons. Although they rushed forward, slashing at the enemy with their blue steel swords, the soldiers found themselves cleaving the air as the Rakshasas rose into the sky. The Rakshasas, who towered over their human foes, would then suddenly descend behind the soldiers, cutting them down with razor-sharp scimitars. Gradually, the demons overpowered the king's army. The battlefield became strewn with the mangled bodies of Anaranya's troops, Blood flowed in waves upon the ground. Heads rolled on the earth with their golden earrings flashing and their teeth clenched in fury. Large and well-muscled arms, still clutching broad swords and lances, lay severed amidst the entrails of slain warriors. The demons sent up great shouts as they hacked down the king's army. Anaranya himself exhibited great prowess. He knew the secrets of the celestial weapons, and by invoking those divine missiles, he killed innumerable Rakshasas. When the demons hid using their sorcery, he released the Shabda weapon of sound, which found them wherever they were. As hordes of Rakshasas rushed at the emperor, he let go the wind weapon, which lifted the demons and hurled them far away. Anaranya was difficult to look upon as he stood in his chariot releasing his weapons. They fell upon the Rakshasa forces like blazing meteors. But the demons far outnumbered the humans. Although hard pressed by the king, the Rakshasas responded with more and more sorcery, vanishing into the sky and entering the earth. Eventually, Ravana's hordes completely annihilated their enemies, and Anaranya stood alone against the demons. Seeing all his forces consumed like so many moths entering a fire, the emperor became infuriated. He went towards Ravana, who had stood by in a war chariot as his Rakshasas fought with the soldiers. Anaranya took up his great bow and let loose 800 fierce arrows which sped like flames of fire toward Ravana. By the incantations of Anaranya, those arrows were imbued with the power of thunderbolts. The king fired them so swiftly that they flew in a long line almost end to end. They struck Ravana furiously on his heads and chest, sounding like claps of thunder. But the demon did not flinch in the least. Angered by the king's sudden attack, Ravana took up a terrible-looking mace. He whirled it above his head with such force that it glowed bright orange and threw off tongues of fire. He flew with the speed of a tempest toward the emperor and struck him a great blow on the forehead. The king fell from his chariot and lay bleeding on the ground. The Rakshasa began laughing and deriding the fallen monarch. What is the use of fighting with Ravana? There is none who can face me in battle and remain alive. Clearly you are a foolish man, too much addicted to wine and women. Thus you have not heard of my unassailable power. Ravana continued insulting the dying king, mocking his ancestral line in which the earth's emperors had appeared for thousands of years. Anaranya looked up at the demon with eyes red from anger. Gasping for breath as his life slipped away, he spoke with difficulty. I have not been killed by you, O vile Rakshasa. Death is certain and comes to all beings according to their destiny. None can be killed before their fate decrees, nor can any be saved when their time has arrived. I am thus killed by my own fate. Do not indulge in self-praise, Ravana, for your own death will soon come. The emperor possessed mystic power, gained by his long practice of austerity. He was loath to waste that accumulated power on Ravana, but the demon had to be checked. The dying king could at least do something before he departed. Anaranya fixed his fading gaze on the Lord of Rakshasas, and concentrating his mind, he uttered a curse. In the very line you now deride, O Ravana, there will soon appear a king who will kill you and all your race. As Anaranya spoke, the sound of kettle drums was heard resounding in the sky, and a shower of celestial flowers fell upon him. Heavenly voices were heard to say, "It shall be so." Having delivered his curse, the emperor slumped to the ground, his life spent. Before the eyes of the demon, Anaranya left his body and rose upward to the heavens, his ethereal form glowing like fire. Ravana snorted derisively. Who cared for the curse of some puny being? What human could ever kill him? He only bothered fighting with them by way of idle sport. Anaranya's curse was simply the insane words of a dying man. It could never come to pass. If any kings dared challenge him, they would meet the same end as this one here. As for the celestial voices, well, he would soon deal with those arrogant deities. The demon again mounted the Pushpaka, which was stationed in the sky. Not being interested in pillaging the paltry wealth of a human city, he left it and soared up into the heavens. Perhaps there were some gods around who could put up a better fight. Ravana went up to the heavenly planets inhabited by the principal gods, but the gods swiftly ran away, unwilling to encounter him in battle. They knew of the inviolable boons of Brahma. It was pointless fighting the demon. The gods prayed to Vishnu, hiding themselves in fear. Ravana decided to rest for a while in heaven. He went to Amaravati, the city of Indra, king of the gods. As the Rakshasa was seated in the celestial Nandana gardens, he saw an apsara, a heavenly nymph named Ramba. The face of that celestial girl shone with incomparable beauty, and she was adorned with bright garlands and jewels. Her soul-captivating eyes glanced here and there, and her fleshy hips swayed as she moved. Ravana gazed upon her large round breast and shapely thighs. Her hands, soft like rose petals, pulled her shining blue dress tight around her body as she saw the demon staring at her. Ravana assumed a godly form of great splendor, concealing his terrible ten-headed body. He sprang to his feet and quickly went over to Ramba, immediately taking her by the hand. Completely overcome by lust, he smiled at the celestial girl. "Where do you go, and whose are you, lovely lady?" he asked. "Who will today enjoy the nectar of your soft red lips? Who will be blessed by the touch of your tender breast? Which fortunate man will be tightly embraced by you, his mind completely captured by carnal delights?" Ravana was not at all concerned whether she was married or not. He had stolen the wives of gods, Gandharvas, and demons everywhere, taking them to Lanka to join his harem. The Rakshasa was accustomed to having his way and spoke only in an attempt to win over Ramba. He praised her divine beauty and told her of his own power and glory. What woman would refuse the opportunity to become the consort of the mighty Ravana? But the beautiful girl did not reciprocate his advances. She pulled away from him, her bright bracelets falling to the ground as she wrested herself from Ravana's grasp. Folding her palms and looking down, she addressed the Rakshasa reproachfully. "Do not speak in this way. I am as good as your daughter, and I therefore deserve to be protected by you, O Ravana. Indeed, I am the wedded wife of another." Ramba told him she was married to a god, Nalakuvera, who is the son of Kuvera, Ravana's own brother. She was thus related to Ravana, and he should not make amorous advances toward her. Ravana laughed loudly. He had no regard whatsoever for any moral codes. He moved towards Ramba, who ran behind a golden bush. Ravana pursued her, pulling off his red silk robes and revealing his immense, lustrous body. The maiden tried to evade him, dodging here and there with her garland and necklaces swinging, but it was useless. Taking hold of Ramba, the Rakshasa forcibly laid her across a nearby rock. He snatched off her garments and began ravishing her. His eyes expanded in delight. Ravana cried out for help, but seeing the fierce Rakshasa, no one dared intervene. Ramba cried for help. But seeing the fierce Rakshasa, no one dared intervene. The demon's powerful hands pinned the white arms of the maiden against the rock. Her dark hair fell in disarray, its golden clasps and flowers dislodged. Ravana violently molested her in front of his demon followers. Although she begged him to desist, the Rakshasa took that struggling heavenly girl against her desire. After Ravana had sated his lust, he stood up, fastened his waistcloth. Shedding tears, Ramba backed away from the demon and fled. Her clothes torn and her garlands crushed, she went before her husband. When he saw her in that condition, Nalakuvera became infuriated. But when he heard it was Ravana who had raped her, he felt helpless. The demon had already defeated Nalakuvera's powerful father, who was supported by innumerable Yaksha warriors. There was no possibility of facing Ravana in a fight. Nalakuvera considered the situation carefully. Although he could not fight the demon, he could at least curse him as a result of his evil act. The righteous curses of the gods invoke the infallible power of Vishnu. Considering this, the only means of punishing Ravana, Nalakuvera touched holy water and then uttered this imprecation. This evil Rakshasa has violated a celestial lady. If he ever again rapes another maiden, he will immediately fall dead. Ravan heard of that curse. He had seen such curses made by gods and rishis come to pass many times. Once uttered, they could not be retracted. Although he did not like to accept it, Ravan could understand that some powerful force maintained the universal order and laws. Thinking it possible that Nala Kuvera's words might just be effective, he decided not to again force himself upon another female. Better not to take any chances. After all, there were enough women who would willingly accept him. Disappointed that no god would fight with him, Ravana left the heavenly planets. He began heading for the southern quarter of the universe where lived the Danas and Daityas, the most powerful celestial demons. Surely they would afford him battle. Who else was there left for him to conquer? As Ravana fled the Pushpaka, he suddenly saw ahead of him the celestial seer, Narada, shining brightly and holding his tambura. The seer plucked the strings gently, singing the praises of Vishnu. Ravana had met him many times before and was pleased to see him. The Rakshasa usually had little time for sages, especially devotees of Vishnu. He preferred to kill and eat rather than speak with them. The rishis and seers generally favored the gods, but Narada was different. He would often give Ravana good advice and seemed his well-wisher. Ravana raised a hand in salute to that sage. The seer came before Ravana and greeted him. Narada could travel freely anywhere in the universe. It was even said that he could leave the materials and journey to Vaikuntha, the spiritual abode of the Lord himself, which knows no decay and is free of all suffering. Narada smiled at Ravana. His large eyes were like two shining sapphires. On his head, his coiled golden hair was held in place by a jeweled silver band. Clad in the soft skin of a black Renku deer, Narada stood in the air in front of Ravana, who invited him onto the chariot. Sitting cross-legged on a golden seat next to the demon, the seer began to address him in gentle, pleasing tones. Why are you harassing this world of humans, O Valiant One? It is already in the grip of death. These people do not deserve to be attacked by you, Ravana, who cannot be overcome by even the entire heavenly host united together. Who would destroy people who are racked by numerous anxieties, surrounded by endless calamities, and are subject to old age and hundreds of diseases? Narada told Ravana that everyone in the material world would in time go to the abode of Yamaraj, the great lord of death. There was no need for Ravana to kill them. Death conquers all. Even the gods would eventually succumb to death. If Ravana should conquer Yamaraj, the entire universe would be conquered. The sage knew that Ravana could not overpower Yamaraj, but he wanted to distract the demon from his evil aim of killing more people and overthrowing the gods. He also had the Rakshasas to greatly increase his sinful actions, assailing the god of death. He also wanted the Rakshasa to greatly increase his sinful actions by assailing the god of death. Ravana would thus create for himself a karmic destiny which would soon result in his own destruction. The demon pondered Narada's suggestion. This sounded interesting. He liked the idea of fighting with the immensely powerful Yamaraj. Perhaps this would be a battle worthy of him. And if death himself were slain, then the whole universal order would be cast into utter chaos. That appealed to Ravan, who wanted to assert himself over any and all powers in the universe. He nodded slowly at Narada, who stood smiling at him. Ravana told the sage he would leave immediately for death's abode. As Narada rose up into the sky, playing upon his tambura, Ravana began heading towards the domain of Yamaraj, the god of justice. As Ravana approached the ethereal region known as Yamalok, he saw everywhere living beings reaping the fruits of their actions. He also saw the millions of soldiers and servants of Yamaraj, known as the Yamadutas. They appeared fierce and unapproachable. Their bodies were powerful, but hideously deformed, covered all over with black hairs that stood erect. In their hands, they held nooses and terrible weapons. Their faces were contorted into frightful expressions, and they yelled and shrieked in dissonant tones. Moving swiftly, they struck and tortured people who were running in all directions. Fearful screams and cries resounded everywhere in that dark and desolate place. Ravana saw in hundreds and thousands, of people being eaten up by fierce dogs, consumed by fires, or being hurled into vats of boiling oil by the Yamadutas. Other unrighteous men and women were running here and there on burning sands, being pursued by Yamadutas holding lances and tridents. Some were being dragged through trees with leaves like steel razors that shredded their bodies. Howling in terrible pain, they would fall to the ground, but their bodies would again become whole. They would then leap up and race off, only to be quickly caught by the Yamadutas and put through the same suffering again. Ravana witnessed innumerable kinds of punishment being meted out to sinful souls. Searching for Yamaraj, he coursed on rapidly in the Pushpaka. In other parts of that mystical and indescribable region, Ravana saw people enjoying celestial delights by virtue of their own good deeds. It seemed as though they were situated in a separate dimension of space and time. Beautiful heavenly landscapes stretched out into the distance. Large shining mansions stood next to clear blue lakes. Young men and women with highly attractive forms were dressed in golden garments and ornaments, embracing one another and laughing. Excellent food and drink was laid out on gold and silver tables. Musicians played and young girls danced. Ravana saw countless people intoxicated with pleasures and entirely oblivious to the scenes of suffering elsewhere. Leaving behind that glowing region of happiness, Ravana continued deeply into Yamaloka. He crossed over the broad Vaitarani River, which flowed with blood and excrement, and came to another dark terrain where countless Yamadutas were relentlessly pursuing wicked persons. The terrible cackles of the Yamadutas echoed there, along with the howls of jackals and wolves. Everywhere stood people who appeared emaciated and pale, seized with unbearable thirst and crying out for water. Descending from his chariot, Ravana began to beat back the Yamadutas, freeing the people they were punishing. He felt no compassion for the pain of others, but he calculated that by oppressing the Yamadutas, he would cause Yamaraj to appear. As the demon freed many people, many thousands of wretched persons from their tormentors, he was suddenly attacked by a massed force of Yamadutas. They assailed Ravana with spears, iron bars, steel clubs, pikes, javelins, and maces. They stood up and began demolishing the seats, dais, pillars, and houses on the Pushpaka. But the indestructible chariot was immediately recreated by the power of Brahma, by whom it had been first fashioned. Ravana's Rakshasa forces fought back against the Yamadutas. Millions upon millions of servants of Yamaraj advanced in great waves. They rained down an unlimited number of arrows and other fierce weapons upon Ravana and his followers. The Rakshasas engaged with the Yamadutas, sending up their terrible war cries. The clash of weapons and the shouts of the warriors sounded like the roaring ocean tossed by a storm. Leaving off the other Rakshasas, the Yamadutas concentrated upon Ravana. Covered all over with their arrows and bleeding profusely, the demon king appeared like a great mountain giving forth streams of red lava. Using his knowledge of mystical weapons, the Rakshasa returned volleys of arrows, spears, maces, rocks, and huge trees. This fearful and deadly shower fell upon the forces of Yamaraj, who stood in front of Ravana. By whirling their maces and lances, the Yamadutas repelled all Ravana's missiles and surrounded him in thousands. They appeared like a mass of carnivorous ants around a large black beetle. Ravana became completely covered by darts and lances, piercing every part of his body. He roared in anger and pain, quickly rising upwards from out of the midst of his assailants. descending to the ground, he held his bow and placed upon it a blazing arrow. The demon invoked the power of Shiva, imbuing the arrow with the divine force that of that immortal god. As the weapon was released, a sheet of fire rushed across the ground, consuming Yamaraj's forces. Enormous orange and white flames leapt in all directions, burning the Yamadutas' bodies to ashes. The ground itself became molten, and the forces of Yamaraj fell back in a confused mass. In the flames' wake came innumerable ghostly followers of Shiva, filling the earth and sky with their terrifying forms. They rushed about the battlefield, striking fear into the Yamadutas' hearts. By the power of Shiva's weapon, waves of fearsome carnivorous beasts sprang up from the ground, howling horribly and tearing at the Yamadutas. Ravana sent up a victory cry, making the ground shake. Hearing that shout, Yamaraj, seated in his palace, could understand that Ravana was overpowering his forces. He ordered his chariot to be fetched and quickly mounted it. Yamaraj stood in his stupendous chariot with the lance and mace in his hands. Angered, the great god burned with a glaring radiance. By his side stood the personified form of Kaladanda, the infallible rod of death, his body a brilliant black and his eyes blazing like two red fires. On the other side of Yamaraj stood the very time spirit himself, the destroyer of the worlds, fearful in appearance. Standing together, those three deities could not be countenanced. On all four sides of the chariot, which looked like a dark mountain, hung the frightful nooses of death. Drawn by 1,000 red and black steeds, shining with a bright luster and having 1,000 great wheels, the celestial chariot advanced with a terrible noise. Seeing that god moving off in anger, all the denizens of heaven trembled. In an instant, Yamaraj's chariot arrived at the spot where Ravana stood roaring. Ravana's followers immediately fled in all directions simply upon seeing the awful chariot. Some of them fell unconscious on the spot. But Ravana himself was not afraid. Seeing his awful adversary, he felt overjoyed, anticipating the fight. The demon stood firm as Yamaraj hurled at him many blazing javelins and iron clubs. They struck Ravana with tremendous force, piercing him and causing streams of blood to flow from his body. Ravana raised his bow to counter Yamaraj's attack. Using sorcery, he fired thousands of straight-flying arrows imbued with the force of a thunderbolt. Those arrows struck Yamaraj all over his body, but the god remained unmoved. Again and again, Ravana fired off his arrows and darts, charging them with celestial power. He struck all the three deities with his fiery weapons, but they stood firm. Yamaraj sent back the demon, countless barbed lances, which struck him violently on the breast. Stunned by those irresistible weapons, Ravana fell unconscious to the ground. Yamaraj observed the rules of fair combat, did not further attack his overpowered enemy. After some time, Ravana came back to his senses and saw Yamaraj still stationed before him. He contemplated his next move. This was indeed a formidable opponent. Rarely was the demon extended in a fight. Ravana rallied himself and stretched his bow to full length, releasing celestial arrows which filled the sky. They fell upon Yamaraj like fiery serpents. Being assailed by those arrows and bleeding profusely, Yamaraj roared in anger. As he opened his mouth, fire covered by billows of smoke issued forth. The whole region was brilliantly illumined by that fire, as if the sun itself had risen in that ever-dark place. Witnessing the astonishing battle between Yamaraj and the Rakshasa, the gods assembled above them. They feared that the dissolution of all the worlds was imminent. Yamaraj's anger would surely annihilate the entire universe. Ravana continuously sent his furious weapons toward the three gods. Death personified, highly enraged by Ravana, then spoke to Yamaraj, "My lord, do not exert yourself further. Let me remain alone here with this Rakshasa. I shall make short work of him. None in the past, no matter how powerful, have been able to overcome me. Every god, rishi, and demon has succumbed to my power. Indeed, all created beings must surely submit to me. There is no doubt about this. Therefore, you need not bother yourself with this wretch any longer. Leave him to me." Yamaraj had become infuriated by Ravana's insolence. He felt insulted, and he told Death to stand back, for he personally would destroy the demon. The god lifted up his mace and gazed upon Ravana. As it was raised, the mace threw off a halo of blazing fire. Yamaraj held it in his hand like the globe of the sun, and he fixed his red eyes on the demon. Just as he was about to release the mace to destroy Ravana, Brahma appeared before him. He was seen and heard only by Yamaraj as he spoke to the angry god. "O immeasurably powerful one, this Rakshasa is not to be killed by you at this time. Indeed, I have conferred upon him a boon that he cannot be slain except by a human. This cannot be falsified, lest the order of the universe be cast into chaos. Therefore, hold back your mace. Ravana is not yet destined to die. If you release your infallible mace upon this demon, it will result in the death of all other created beings." Long ago, Ravana had pleased Brahma by performing difficult asceticism and had won from the god a boon. Brahma had granted Ravana immunity from being slain by any beings except for humans or animals, whom Ravana utterly disregarded. Hearing that command of Brahma, the chief of the gods, Yamaraj, lowered his mace. Realizing that nothing could be accomplished by him in that battle, he then and there disappeared from Ravana's sight. When he saw Yamaraj depart, the Rakshasa considered himself victorious and roared in joy. Now he was surely the most powerful being in the universe. What was there left to prove? Even the great lord of death had run away from him. Ravana looked around and saw that the slain Yamadutas had been brought back to life by Yamaraj's power. Ignoring Ravana, they continued their grisly task of meting out punishment. Ravana felt he had no further purpose to achieve in Yamalok. He had established his supremacy, and that was all he desired. It was time to return to Lanka, his golden city. Getting aboard the Pushpaka, he left that region, followed by his forces, and flew to the north, heading again for the earth planet where Lanka was situated. Part 1, Chapter 1, King Dasarath's Longing. King Dasarath paced his palace balcony. His handsome brow was furrowed in a pensive mood. He surveyed the scene around him. People thronged the inner courtyard below. Feudal kings and princes came with their retinues to pay tribute. From his seventh-story terrace, Dasarath could see much of his city, which stretched to the horizon in all directions. Crowds of citizens moved along the well-planned roads, which were interspersed with mango groves and orchards. The broad central highway, built entirely of red stone, ran the full 100-mile length of the city. Large white mansions lined that road, with many colored pennants waving in the breeze on their roofs. The road was sprinkled with perfumed water and strewn with flowers. Above the city, the king could see the golden airplanes of Apsaras, the consorts of the gods. Looking out over his capital, Ayodhya, Dasarath was plunged in an ocean of anguish. He entered the palace and walked slowly toward his inner chambers. As he descended the wide marble stairways, he heard his priests chanting sacred Sanskrit texts. The sound of mantras mingled with that of drums and lutes being beautifully played by royal musicians. Even that sound, which normally gave him so much joy, could not placate him. The king entered his rooms, leaving his personal guards at the door. Declining the food and drinks offered to him by his maidservants, he went over to the large latticed window. He moved aside the silk drapes and continued gazing out at his city. Ayodhya had been constructed by Manu, a son of Surya, the all-powerful sun god. Manu had been the first of the kings in Dasarath's line, all of them emperors of the globe. As he thought of his long ancestry, the king only felt more pain. he sighed and turned back into his rooms. Seeing the anxious king, his three queens tried gently to console him. They sat him on a large golden couch covered with silk pillows and studded with gems. His senior wife, Kaushalya, gently massaged his feet, while Sumitra and Kaikeyi fanned him with snow-white chamra whisks. The king sat, lost in thought. He looked at the exquisite carvings of the gods lining his walls. All his life he had done so much to please those deities. Once he had even gone into battle against the celestial demons on their behalf. Surely they would help him now. Dasarath silently prayed to them. While the king sat absorbed in his thoughts and prayers, a messenger came telling him that his chief priest, Vashishta, was now present in the assembly hall. Dasarath had been waiting for this news. He rose up and, with the gait of a powerful lion, went along the wide palace passageways, his large sword swinging at his side and his gold ornaments jangling as he walked. Near to the hall, he was joined by his chief ministers. All of them were heroes who had been tried in battle, and all were learned and wise. The state ran smoothly under their expert administration. There were no citizens without employment and no criminals left unchecked. The ministers were devoted to Dasarath's service, and as they walked, they considered the problem facing the king. Flanked by his bodyguards and ministers, Dasarath entered his great hall. It vied in splendor with the assembly hall of Indra, the king of the gods. Massive marble pillars rose up to a roof which seemed to reach the sky. Balconies of alabaster and coral, worked with gold filigree, were gradually tiered all around the hall. Along the balconies were gold seats spread with white cushions. Large silk tapestries depicting the pastimes of the gods hung from the walls, which were lined with lapis lazuli and encrusted with jewels. The air was filled with the scent of incense. In the center of the hall sat numerous priests who continuously chanted prayers from the ancient scriptures invoking the presence of deities. The great megadrum resounded deeply as Dasarath strode toward his seat. Everyone stood, and there was a cry of victory. All glories to Emperor Dasarath. The king, appearing like a god, took his seat on the large throne of refined gold bedecked with brilliant celestial gems. A hush descended on the assembly as Dasarath prepared to speak. Everyone sat in expectation. The citizens knew of the king's worry. They loved him like a father and shared his anxiety. They were grouped in the hall according to their class. At the front were the Brahmins wearing simple cloth and holding their water pots and prayer beads. On one side sat the warriors, their powerful bodies clad in silks and gold ornaments, with long swords hanging from their belts. Near to them were the tradespeople in their colorful dress, and behind them were the servants and workers, also beautifully adorned. All social classes were represented in that assembly. Dasarath looked around the hall, smiling affectionately at everyone. Although the king was preoccupied with his worry, no one could detect in him any negligence or laxity in his duties. Seeing him smiling at them, the people felt reassured that Dasarath would find a solution to his problem. They sat, awaiting his speech. Placing his hand on his gold scepter, the king turned to his chief priest, Vashishta, who sat on a raised seat near the throne. With a powerful voice that boomed around the hall, Dasarath addressed the priest. "I have called this assembly to settle a great worry of mine. As you know, this wide earth has for a long time been held under the sway of victorious kings in my line. O jewel of among sages, is that glorious history about to end? What can I do to ensure that our proud lineage will continue?" Dasarath was perturbed that he had no son. Having ruled as the undisputed emperor of the earth for thousands of years, his retirement was now approaching, but there was no one to succeed him. Somehow, none of his wives had given birth to a son. The king had called for a full assembly to propose an idea he was considering. He needed the approval of the Brahmins, and he wanted the consent of his people. Dasarath looked anxiously at Vashishta, who was both his priest and preceptor. O learned one, you know well the perils that attend a kingdom bereft of a monarch. How can I retire to the forest, leaving this world without a protector? Vasishtha sat surrounded by many other Brahmin sages. His hand rested upon his staff as he listened to Dasarath. The sun shone through the carved lattice windows of the hall, covering the king with golden light. Vasishtha, shining with his own mystic power, appeared like a second sun as he replied to the king, O emperor, I have no doubt that you will soon be blessed with a powerful son who can succeed you. Not long ago, I heard this told by Sanat Kumar, the immortal sage who roams the universe. A divine arrangement is being worked by the gods for your everlasting benefit. Vasishtha lived in a hermitage outside the city. He was frequently visited by wandering sages and mystics. Some days previously, the famous seer Sanat Kumar, who always appeared like a young boy, had spoken with Vasishtha. He told him that soon four powerful sons would be born to the emperor. These sons would be divine incarnations, appearing to fulfill the purpose of the gods. Vasishtha continued, The Brahmins have all been praying to the Lord for your sake, O monarch. We have seen auspicious signs in the heavens. It is clear that some great plan of the Supreme will be achieved through you. The king felt joy to hear this priest's words. Like his forebears before him, Dasarath had religiously pursued his duties as emperor. Under his benevolent rule, the world enjoyed prosperity and peace. The king desired not only the immediate material enjoyment of his people, but their spiritual well-being as well. He kept everyone on the path of piety and truth, leading them toward freedom from the cycle of birth and death. Seeing all the people as his own children, he was concerned that their happiness would continue after his retirement. He spoke again, I have been considering the performance of a horse sacrifice for the pleasure of the gods and Vishnu. O noble sages, will this be successful? Can I satisfy the Lord in this way and thereby attain my desired end? Dasarath knew nothing could be achieved unless Vishnu, the Supreme Lord, was pleased. Although they controlled the universe, the other gods were but Vishnu's agents. Many times in the past, the king's ancestors had performed great sacrifices for satisfying the Lord and achieving their purposes. The king now considered this to be his only means of deliverance. He looked hopefully at Vasishtha, who had been speaking with the other sages at his side. Turning toward the king, Vasishtha said, We are in agreement, O tiger among men. Let the sacrifice proceed. We shall immediately prepare a ground on the banks of the Sarayu, and you will certainly get a son by this method. The assembly erupted with joyful shouts. Everywhere were cries of, Let it be so! Let the sacrifice proceed! The king, his eyes grown wide with delight, as he anticipated the fulfillment of his desire, said to Vasishtha, Let the preparations begin today. Protected by 400 of my best warriors, the sacrificial horse will roam the globe before returning for the sacrifice. After Dasarath had issued all necessary instructions, the assembly was dismissed, and the king retired to his inner chambers. Together with his wives, he worshipped Vishnu and the gods, praying that his sacrifice would succeed. And thus ends tonight's reading of the Ramayana, India's immortal tale of adventure, love, and wisdom, retold by Krishna Dharmadas. All glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to Lord Ram. Gaur Premanande Hari Hari Bo.
Hare Krishna, Hare Hari Bo.
Hare Hari Bo.
Hare Krishna, Dandat Pranam. Dandat Pranam.
So, again, we've started the yajna.
Hare Krishna.
Okay. Everyone, please say Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna
to everybody.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. So watch for announcements. We'll keep the vibration of the Ramayana going all the way until the holy appearance of Ramachandra. All glories to the assembled devotees. Gaur Premanande Hari Hari Bo. Vancha Kalpatrubhascha Kripasanabhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo. Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Gaur Premanande.